Thank you to Cash App for sponsoring this episode.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Maya is a teacher, artist, and multi-crime survivor from Los Angeles. After finishing her undergraduate degree in Spanish at the age of 22, Maya found herself seeking direction. But it was only a couple months after her graduation that she experienced a life-changing armed robbery. Not long after that, she would travel to Argentina and forge a new life for herself, far from the San Fernando Valley. However, she would be faced with even more tumult and trauma when political and socioeconomic crises in her new home increased crime rates, exposing her to the harsh reality of a nation's unrest. The Broken Cycle Media team is so grateful that Maya was willing to share all that came next for her as a multi-crime survivor. And I am especially, personally grateful for her because she's one of my best friends and my cousin.
Hi, my name's Maya. I am Amy's cousin, and I am so happy to be here. It's an honor to be part of your podcast. I was very surprised to be invited. I didn't realize I had so much to share till we started talking about it. I was raised by a strong woman that knew what she wanted, went after it. She was a teacher, an artist, a traveler, an inspiration to everyone. A survivor herself of cancer various times. She counseled cancer survivors, and that to me is so admirable. What my mom taught me is just the passion for life, for teaching, for connecting with other humans. She adopted you as her daughter too when your mom was murdered. I developed my love of art with my mom growing up. When I look back, I can distinguish when I picked up art. I was trying to get out of a relationship. I was trying to get over something. I was moving on from a difficult time, one door closes, another door opens type situation. And something I learned from my dad that's awesome is if there are more positives than negatives, you stay with something. And if there are more negatives than positives, you leave. I've used that throughout my life. And that's the best words of advice about making important decisions in life is I examine everything. I'm a realist. I look at facts. I consider my emotions and I make rational decisions. In my younger years in school, I just didn't really have too many friends. My childhood was filled with a lot of feeling like that I don't belong. I went to a private school where a lot of my classmates had a lot of money. I was shamed for not having as much, for having a smaller house, for not wearing the brand name clothes. As a kid, I always prided myself in one thing. I never conformed. I always stuck to who I was. I never caved to peer pressure, ever. I did not become anyone that I wasn't. If someone was my friend, it was because they liked me. I remember in high school, there was a friend that dumped me because I wouldn't ditch with her and hop over a very tall fence. I said, no, thank you. And she never talked to me again. I actually enjoyed ninth grade a lot because I was at a public school where there was just all different income levels, multicultural. First time I'd seen that and I loved it. And then moved in 10th grade. It was the same type of situation I felt like I was in when I was in fourth to eighth grade. So I was kind of back to being the new person, not included, just trying to find my place and make friends. I had one boyfriend in high school. It's interesting because the day I saw him being violent toward his brother, I ended that. After that, I was focused on going to college. I got good grades in high school. I didn't take any AP classes or anything extra because I knew I would just get in. I went to Cal State Northridge and I loved it. I had a part-time job. I paid a lot of my way. The neat thing about the dorm I was staying in, it was a private dorm across from campus. There were different exchange students from different countries that would come and stay for 6 months. We had students from El Salvador, France, Argentina, and the group from Argentina, I made a few friends, and it was finally my little happy place because I met lots of interesting people. My major was Spanish, but there were two options when you study Spanish. There was literature and there was language and culture, and I picked the language and culture option. I started going to Cal State Northridge in the early 90s, and I was actually there during the Northridge quake. It was technically a 6.7, but we felt it in Northridge in the epicenter as if it were an 8.5. I thought I was going to die that moment that it was happening. It felt like it was 30 minutes, but it was only 11 seconds. It was so scary. I don't know how I made it to my doorway. I sat in the doorway. I literally saw black. I couldn't hear anything. It was really loud. I'm lucky that my TV did not fall on top of me and hit me because I saw it on my bed later. I had a fish tank. The tank broke, little dead fish all over the place. It didn't end there. That night, there was an aftershock of 5 point something, and we were all huddled on the football field across the street. And for 6 months, we had aftershocks. They actually moved our department to bungalows. So we were reminded of it for so long. They were busing us over to the UCLA library because our library was all destroyed. It was just a big mess. It left all of us depressed because we had to relive it every aftershock. Some people packed up and went home. I graduated in 96. I was about 22, I would say. When I graduated, my plan, I guess, was to be a Spanish teacher. I grew a love for the Latino culture. I wanted to live in Latin America because I wanted to be a Spanish teacher. I wanted to be well-rounded. But I was kind of a little lost when I graduated. So I got a job at a bank as a teller. The bank that I worked at had no protection or barrier between you and the customer. There was no plexiglass. There was no anything. It was just the teller and the customer right there face to face. This particular branch was right next to the freeway on-ramp at a busy intersection. So it was easy access for people to rob the bank and hit the road. We got robbed like every couple weeks. They would call it a note passer. So a note passer gives the teller a note that says, I have a gun, give me your money. And the teller gives them the money. They have the option of giving them a dye pack, which if you give out a dye pack, what happens is you go through the doors and the dye pack would go off. The money turns red. So they obviously can't use it. I never got a note, but what happened every time there would be a note passer and people give the thief the money, they would close down the bank, call the cops. And this happened like every 2 weeks. The day that I quit was the day that we actually had a shooter. I'm someone that never gets sick, but for whatever reason, I wasn't feeling well that day. So I just lay down on the couch for a few minutes and there was a monitor there. I didn't hear anything. I saw on the monitor a guy with a big gun waving it back and forth. I'm not a gun expert, but it was probably a shotgun or something longer. And he was masked. I'm like, is this really happening? What I did, it was just instinctual. I went behind a door. I went to the wall phone. I called 911 and I hid behind the door and I told them what was happening, but almost whispering because I didn't want to get caught. After I got off the phone, I just stayed behind the door, didn't say anything. I don't know how many minutes passed by. I was thinking to myself, maybe I'm the only one that's calling the cops. And if I did, maybe I helped save someone. All I knew is that I had to do it. I didn't think twice about it. I was so scared for my colleagues. I did not move until somebody came back and said, oh yeah, it's over. And I felt safe to get out from behind the door. But I don't know how long I was back there. I might have been there 20 minutes. They closed down the bank like they always did with note passers, but this was different. The people that were actually there experiencing in person were, I'm sure, traumatized. I was traumatized because I saw this happening on a monitor. They brought in a psychologist. I believe the bank arranged that. It was that day. I don't think I shared at all. I don't think any of us shared much. We were just in this state of bewilderment, like, what's happening and why the hell am I working at this place? I don't know what happened to that criminal, but I remember the psychologist telling us a scary story. There was a guy that somebody gave him the dye pack. He had it in his pocket. The dye pack exploded when he left the bank and he became impotent. So he actually sued the bank and won because they gave him the dye pack. That was crazy because I thought, oh my God, I could have been the one that gave him the dye pack. I could have been sued. I went home and I was like, I'm done. I quit.
It is official. I have currently entered my girls' trip era, and I can safely say that the only drawback to traveling with your best girlfriends is figuring out how to split the bill. I've used apps that can take days to transfer funds, and then others that have made it impossible to get my money back when I send it to the wrong person. Finding Cash App has literally changed everything for me. Cash App is safe, easy, and fast. Honestly, the setup is painless and instant, and it only requires your email or phone number. Plus, they've got this great philosophy that my money is just that, my money, and I deserve it when it's there. Also, Cash App lets you customize your payments with texts and backgrounds, and they even send warning notifications if they detect you're about to send money to a scam. And for a limited time only, new Cash App users can use our exclusive code to earn some additional cash. Yes, you heard me right. There is no catch. Just download Cash App and sign up. Then use our exclusive referral code WHATCAMENEXT in your profile. Send $5 to a friend within 14 days, and you'll get $10 dropped right into your account. Terms apply. That's money. That's Cash App. Thank you to Cash App for sponsoring this episode.
At the same time that this bank robbery happened and I quit that job, I would say within a week or two, the person that I was in a relationship with for 2 years hit me for the first time. It was a shock. He didn't leave a bruise, but he slapped me in the face. I don't care who you are, you're not going to do that to me. So I left immediately. I took my stuff out of the apartment, put him in my parents' place. I remember coming to my parents' house and saying, look, he hit me, I'm done. Basically, I had to move on from there. So left the job, left the guy. What happened also at that time, I had a friend I met in college. She was from Argentina. We kept in touch. This was letters back and forth. She would always invite me to Argentina. Like, this is your house, come see me. We'd love to have you. She had an apartment with her mom in Buenos Aires, in the capital. My decision to go visit my friend in Argentina, it kind of naturally flowed because I was looking for something else. I was looking to fit in and belong. I was looking to find a connection. And I thought I found it in this friend. I went there thinking I'm going to visit a friend that really wants me to be there. She was nice for like a couple days. Basically, she ignored me for the rest of the trip. But I'm not someone that curls up in a ball and just gives up. So I decided to have fun in my own way. Her mom was super nice to me, and she took me out to tango lessons. I danced with the teacher. It was amazing. I stayed at her apartment between a week and a week and a half, enough to get a taste of the culture, and I loved it. Her mom was so nice to me. I made friends with the lady that took care of the house. I felt like I made a friend in her. Something in me said, you know what? You need to return here. So I went back after my trip. I packed up my stuff, threw it in my parents' house. 3 months later, I moved to Argentina. I ended up in Buenos Aires. It was just me, the clothes on my back, and I had a little bit of pocket change or whatever. But I got there. It was a big city. I was in a nice part of town where it was considered safe. I don't know how it fell upon me, but I found a hostel. It was a woman who owned a house that had two kitchens, two or three bathrooms. I rented a room there. It was a little room, and I met lots of really cool people, all different ages. We'd go out dancing. I washed clothes by hand upstairs on the terrace, and we'd hang them out to dry. It was an adventure. I would say my life has been an adventure, but this was one of them where I felt like I fit in. Everyone else that I was living with there, we were all friends. I was lucky enough to find work. In Buenos Aires, I taught at private institutes. I would give one-on-one classes, test prep, general English, all kinds of different types of tutoring. I was fluent in Spanish, but in Argentina, they have a lot of vocabulary words that Spanish speakers out here would not know. So I went there and I learned a lot of slang and a lot of other expressions and stuff. I was in Buenos Aires for a year and a half. That's where I met my now ex-husband. We met at the hostel there. We decided we wanted to be together, and we moved to Mar del Plata, which is a different city in Argentina, about a few hours from the capital. Mar del Plata, which is a beachside town. There's a casino there. There's a touristy part. There's a rich part. And then there's the part that we lived in, which is on the outskirts of the city. It was a bit on the more rural side. When I was in Mar del Plata, I made friends with my good friend. We're still friends today. She was my neighbor, and I've known her kids since they were little. We'd have barbecues and the best beef in Argentina. That's what I miss about Argentina, is the cheeses, the coffee, and the meat. Most of the time I lived in Argentina, I was there technically as a tourist. And a tourist can only stay 3 months without exiting the country. Before we got married, I would have to leave the country every 3 months to get a new stamp on my passport so that I can be in the country another 3 months legally. There was a boat. It would take us to Uruguay, and I would literally just get off the ferry, get a stamp, get back on the next one and head back. And that was every 3 months. It was a 45-minute boat ride, so it wasn't a big deal. But it was just something I had to do every 3 months. It was just the norm. And when I was living in Buenos Aires, it was easy. Get to the port, do my thing. And when I was living in Mar del Plata, I'd have to take a long-distance bus for a few hours to get to where I needed to take the boat and come back. One of the times I was getting a stamp on my passport, the lady said to me, "You can't keep doing this. You need to get your papers." So that's when I said to my boyfriend at the time, we were together a long time, I said, "Can we get married and I can get my papers?" He said yes. So we got married. When I got to Argentina, Menem was in power. I don't remember violent crimes. The peso and the dollar were 1-to-1. People would complain about him, but it was peaceful. And then what happened was his term was done in December 1999. After his presidency, we went through a couple presidents because they quit. It was not good. The peso dropped. At the time, a car tire maybe was $80. And suddenly it's $380. It was considered a socioeconomic crisis. It was so bad that they had to close the banking system for a whole year so that it wouldn't crumble, which meant people could not withdraw any savings. You could go with a check from your job and cash it, but you couldn't withdraw any money. There were people outside banks with wads of cash, exchanging money, dollars, pesos, making money, because it was just so crazy how the peso kept dropping. And with that came violent crimes and robberies. The money I made from my job, which is not a lot, I kept it in my fridge in a plastic bag. People would bury money in their yard in a plastic Ziploc. I had no savings in the bank because I was told not to trust the system. Where I was living, there was just no protection. You didn't feel protected by anybody. I went through various robberies in my 4.5 years living in Mar del Plata. We rented a room. It was like a studio apartment, let's say, separate from the main house. We got robbed twice from that apartment. There were bars on the windows. So imagine somebody cutting a circle around the bars through the stucco And they basically removed the stucco with the bars off and left a hole in the wall. I know it was by my neighbors that lived across the street because they were listening to my CDs that they stole. The lady was wearing my boots and I could do nothing about it.
I had a feeling it would happen again and there was nothing I could do about it. I had to go to work. I had to catch the bus. So when I left the house, the kids that lived across the street, they were teens and they were part of the whole group of thieves, shall we say. They were playing ball right in front of where I lived, right by the gate, as if they were taunting me, telling me that they were going to do that and I had no power to stop them. It was a horrible feeling. I left to go to work. And when I came back, the stucco with the bars were removed again from the wall. So second time, exact same thing. Nothing was done about it. I got no follow-up from the police. The feeling of no protection is just so predominant there.
And the reason being, in Argentina, at the time I was there, the corruption was so institutionalized and everybody knew it. The police, the lawyers, and the criminals were all in it together. So the criminals would steal, the lawyers would protect them, and the police would cash in on money too. It was horrible. When the peso dropped and this violent crime erupted, I had a friend who had a convenience store. They've had this convenience store for years. Like clockwork, they got robbed every 2 weeks. This is what we lived through. And hearing it firsthand from my friend, it's still traumatic, even though it didn't happen to me personally. It was happening to someone I cared about. It was happening to everyone. It was just insane. And then I also got held up at gunpoint. My husband at the time, he delivered goods from a warehouse to various convenience stores. He told me every day he got pulled over by cops asking him for bribes. They wanted money from him because they thought he had money. The plates were correct. The tags were correct. Everything was in line. If you look like you have money, which we didn't, then they try to get money from you. This happened to him every single day. But my husband was tougher than them, and he actually helped me become a stronger person with his example. He would tell the police that pulled him over, he would say, "You can hold me here as long as you want. I am not giving you a penny." I went with him one time. We were driving from one little neighbor to the next. Now, in Argentina, there were lots of neighborhoods that were very, very poor. People hooking up to other people's electricity and cable. We're driving on a dirt road. There were little kids that came out and they threw rocks at our van. They're 3-year-olds, 5-year-olds. He told me, this is what they do. Little kids throw rocks at your car so that you get out, get angry, and the adults come and steal from you. So the adults have these kids working for them in crime. He said, no, we're going to keep going because this is what they do. When we finally got to the neighborhood where we were delivering the next batch of goods to, I suddenly felt something and I looked to the side and there's a robber with a gun at my head. He said in Spanish, "Give me all your money." And I said, "I don't have any money." At the time, his partner was in the back of the van trying to get money from my husband. After all this happened, he came back in the van and he told me what happened. And he said, "I gave him 40 or 60 pesos just to get rid of him. But when you're not here, I don't give them a penny. If they want to steal from me, I will chase them. I do not give them anything. But since you were there and I didn't want anything to happen to you, I gave them a little money." And that was the last time I went to work with him. He was a tough guy. I'm grateful to him for teaching me to be a tougher person because I wasn't. This was a character building relationship. I learned a lot from him. We moved from that house because we were over it. So we moved into the main part of town into an apartment that was secure. And I was much happier there. Once that happened, it was just like living in a normal apartment. I had a dog. I'd take her out walking in between my classes. And I felt a lot safer in that living situation. I got a job as a teacher in a private bilingual school. It was in a gorgeous place in the middle of a forest. It took me like 2 or 3 buses to get there. It took me 1.5 hours to get there each way. They gave me this 6th grade class that nobody else wanted. So I taught 6th grade Monday through Friday, part-time, maybe 4 hours or something. And then on Fridays, I had an 8th and 9th grade class. The kids that went to this school were very rich. Their parents were diplomats. They were important people in the community. At the time, each kid, it cost $400 or $500 per month. And at the time, that was a lot of money. And a lot of these kids, there were 3 or 4 kids in the family. So these people came from money. And in Argentina, at the time, you're either poor or you're rich. The middle class almost didn't exist. I was considered poor, and I was teaching these rich kids. And it was almost taking me back to my school experience. As a teacher, I had one rule, and it was respect. One time I gave a test and I warned them before, because it was a rowdy group. Before the test, I said, if anyone talks, they would get a 0. And 5 kids talked during the test and they thought I was full of it. I gave them a 0, as I said I would. The next day, I was called into the office in the middle of class by the principal. The principal says to me, you can't give any 0s. We had a father call and complain, and you can't count that test. And at that point, I realized what I was dealing with. Parents basically bought grades, if you want to think of it that way. I felt like I had this loyalty to the kids. So I stuck it out for the rest of the school year, and it was bad because once kids lose respect for you, you have nothing. You can't teach them effectively. And that's what happened because I was not respected by the administration. So kids did not respect me. That was my last private school I worked in or will ever work in. At the same time I was teaching there, I got a job at a language institute. And it's funny, the name was called Speakeasy. And I enjoyed teaching, but I felt really alone there. I didn't feel a warm welcome by any of the teachers. Nobody wanted to hang out or be my friend outside of work. The political situation was the same. I just wasn't happy. My husband at the time, he just didn't seem interested in me. I was there because I was loyal to him and I didn't feel love from him. I had a dog that I loved. She was like my little baby. When I finally realized that I wasn't happy and I needed to make a change, I went into therapy for 6 months where I discovered what I pretty much already knew. I had to leave him. I had to leave the country. And sadly, I had to leave my dog. And that's what broke my heart. It was the hardest thing to do. By the 6 month period that was up, I was over him. I got over it. That was my process. I realized he didn't love me. I realized I was not happy in this country. And I had to leave. I bought my $800 plane ticket. I had $200 in my pocket and I came back to the US. And I just had to start my life from scratch. I was depressed for a few months. I missed my dog. My only consolation was that she ended up on his sister's farm. And if I were a dog, I would pick a farm as my home too. That made me feel a little better, but it was really tough.
When I came back from Argentina, I remember I was so sensitive to people coming up to me from behind. I hated it. It would trigger me so bad. I don't know how long I had that fear. It was directly related to all those times of being robbed in Argentina, the 3 times specifically. And of course, the one in the US where it started right before I went to Argentina. So many different violations that I felt in Argentina. It was just too much. The fear and the uncertainty, the political situation, the socioeconomic situation, my physical and emotional well-being was just off kilter because it was just so traumatic.
It was really easy for me to leave and it was very difficult for me to come back. I was very grateful to be back in the US and I felt like our system at least made me feel safe. I know our criminal justice system has flaws, but where I lived, it was way more than flaws. It was just an entirely corrupt chaos that I needed to get away from. For 2 years, I lived in the cute little beach town that my family would go to all the time. And it was so peaceful. It's a small town, population 16,000. I found a good friend next door, a woman that I had known my whole life, and we were friends. Some of the ways I've healed since returning, I do art. I joined a jet ski community club. I've done all kinds of healing type of activities. I got into salsa and bachata dancing, and that was a way to cope. I'm an ocean person. I love being on the ocean. I love working with communities that need extra support. I love working with inner city kids. I feel a deep connection with them. I ended up going back to LA and I moved back into the Valley. Things were peaceful. I was teaching. I registered in a credential master's program, combo program. So I was taking classes at night. After living in Argentina for 6 years and going through all the traumas and difficulties I had there, I really believe it solidified what I wanted to do. I wanted to teach. I wanted to give back. I wanted to inspire other people. I wanted to be of service and help. I'm a person that cares about people, and I always have to be in a job where I help try to bring out the best in people.
Something has been running through my head. There's a term that a friend of mine, her name is Lenora Claire. She's an advocate and a speaker and a survivor. She's amazing. One of the ways she describes herself is a multi-crime survivor. And that term really struck me because I had never heard of it. But when I hear your life experiences from a very long portion of time, you're a multi-crime survivor. When I say that to you, what does that feel like?
It feels like it's fitting. And it also feels like, oh my gosh, I never thought of it like that. When you initially asked me to be interviewed, you were mentioning when I worked at the bank and we got robbed at the bank. And I thought, well, I don't have too much to say about that. But then I started remembering, oh my gosh, I went through this, I went through that, I went through that. And what I believe as a multi-crime survivor, I honestly didn't see myself as that until just now. Thank you, Amy. It took me some time, but I came into my own. I haven't been on survival mode for a long time. I've been in living mode. I enjoy my life. I'm happy every day. I always see the good in every day. There was a post-it that I saw on a teacher's wall, and it said, not every day is good, but there is good in every day. And that's how I see it.
What words of wisdom or encouragement would you give to anybody listening that might have related to any portion that you shared?
I would say be true to yourself, honor yourself, respect your own boundaries. It's really hard to be someone that has clear boundaries, that doesn't let someone trample on their boundaries. And that's a challenge for me to this day. I think that's the most important thing is respect. You can get through traumatic times. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. And the people that we bring into our lives help so much. I've never been someone that has lots of friends, but I don't care. If I have a few close people in my life, I'm grateful and I'm happy. That's all I need. And Amy, you're one of those people.
What compelled you to share with us?
You inspired me. You were so supportive of my life and my journey as I am of yours. And I was so moved. And when you said that your listeners might really be interested in what I have to say, I thought that would be awesome. I was touched. And also, it really feels cathartic. And I never really looked at my life in this way. I never really put together all these traumas. The most recent trauma was the death of my mom. And that was a year and 5 months ago. And I miss her every day. And your mom was the one that inspired me to teach high school instead of middle school. And that one piece of advice just changed my life because I love high school age kids. And I was just thinking about your mom, and sometimes the adult supports the child and sometimes it goes the other way around. I remember your mom supporting me in my teaching, and I remember supporting her when she was going through a tough time with her son, and I was being supportive of her. My mom was witness to him threatening her with a blowtorch. And after that, I said, please, please, I know you love him, but get him out of the house. I felt such a deep connection at that moment. And I felt so scared for her. I just wanted to reach out and hold her and hug her and say, honor yourself. I mean, she had such a big heart for everyone. And my mom did too.
Thank you very much for such a poignant perspective of just how so many things can affect the way that we navigate the world, and our political, socioeconomic situation affects us deeply.
It was wonderful. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I was so honored that you asked me to speak. I didn't think I had so much to share, but I guess I did. And I hope it helps someone that's out there listening.
Carlos Menem was president of Argentina from 1989 to 1999. Amidst his terms, President Menem was accused of widespread corruption. Simultaneously, though, his economic policies aided in a major financial reform for the country. In 1997, when Maya arrived in Argentina, the dollar to Argentinian peso exchange rate was about 1-1, as Maya mentioned. However, over the years, the conversion rate and economy continued to shift. In fact, after Menem left office in 1999 and until Maya left the country in 2003, Argentina would see five presidents take office. Of those five presidents, three of them filled the position for 7 days or less. And as several news and media outlets report, Argentina saw a rather drastic spike in crime at the beginning of the 2000s. As an analysis of violence and public policy in Argentina by Argentine professor Sebastian A. Cutrona states, quote, Argentina's crime rates increased drastically during the 1990s, reaching historical levels in the 2001 economic crisis. While a total of 498,290 crimes of all types were registered in 1991, in 1999, the figures were almost double, accounting for a total of 1,062,241 illegal acts. Argentina's crime rates, in other words, shifted from 1,484 to 2,904 crimes per 100,000 inhabitants. After experiencing a peak in 2002, when the country recorded a high of 3,573 crimes per 100,000 inhabitants, the trend went downward thereafter. End quote. Relatedly, a history of bribery, embezzlement, theft, fraud, extortion, and other corruption was reported to be a part of Argentina's political landscape for decades. And as a 1996 New York Times article shares, at the time the article was written, Argentina was a place, quote, where payoffs, kickbacks, and government corruption were considered part of everyday life, end quote. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I said, if this light is in here, this proves that I'm overreacting. And as I'm opening the bag, I'm putting my hand in, all I feel is metal. And I instantly pull out two large butcher knives, a pair of scissors, and disinfect it. I drop everything on the counter and I start screaming. I was staring at a wall for like an hour. And I just kept saying, I told you she was going to kill me. I told you she was going to kill me. And at that point, they had already taken her and put her into the ambulance. And then they shut my street down as an attempted murder scene.
Thank you to Cash App for sponsoring this episode. For a limited time only, new Cash App users can use our exclusive code to earn some additional cash. Yes, you heard me right. There is no catch. Just download Cash App and sign up. Then use our exclusive referral code WHATCAMENEXT in your profile. Send $5 to a friend within 14 days, and you'll get $10 dropped right into your account. Terms apply. That's money. That's Cash App.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.